Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where today we're asking who wants a piece of the Four Seasons. Now, New York's Four Seasons restaurant was one of the most famous and prestigious dining rooms in the world. It closed last week and its contents are being sold at Wright's Auction House tomorrow, the 26th of July. Who cares? Well, lots of people. And talking of auctions, many of the fixtures, fittings and paintings are better loved having been used and having been party to, well, parties than any of the artefacts that come up in any mere auction of art. What was the Atmos?
It was really a theatre, and they really created just the most special ambiance.
So take your chair, flourish your napkin, and look forward to diving into that famous menu, The Four Seasons for Sale. That is today's Culture with me, Robert Bound. Do stay tuned. Four Seasons first opened its doors in 1959. Two huge rooms located at the bottom of Mies van der Rohe's architectural masterpiece, the Seagram Building on New York's Park Avenue. It's hosted a glittering list of diners over the decades. Sure, it's hosted JFK, supermodels, power brokers, and captains of industry, but it's far from just a gossipy hotspot. The Four Seasons was responsible for the Power Lunch. It was the first restaurant to offer a seasonal menu and put the idea of fine dining into English, opting out of the usual Francais. The impeccable modernist interior was designed by van der Rohe and Philip Johnson, and it included an opulent bar, the impressive grill room with floor-to-ceiling windows, and the jewel in the crown, the pool room, centred around a raised pool of Carrara marble. And this was no modest feat. The restaurant had a budget of $4.4 million, which translates to over $30 million in 2016 terms. Each season, the restaurant was overhauled, new uniforms, new foliage, a brand new menu, a new upholstery. No expense was spared. Earlier on this month, the final meal was served in the Four Seasons, as everyone knew it. The owner of the Seagram Building, Abby Rosen, announced that the restaurant's lease would not be renewed, and the owners, Julian Nicolini and Alex von Bidder, have secured a new location just down the road. On the show today, we're going to be discussing the cultural legacy of a restaurant that's lasted longer than most ever will, and whether reservation means so much more than the food. Kicking us off with a bit more background is Professor of History at Yale University and author of 10 Restaurants That Changed America, Paul Friedman.
The restaurant is the creation of Joe Baum, who was a restaurant executive, and of Phyllis Lambert, the daughter of the head of the Seagram family. Mm-hmm. The restaurant was in the Seagram Building on Park Avenue in Midtown Manhattan, and the original design for the building was as a fairly mediocre box, and Phyllis Lambert convinced her father to have it designed by the leading architects of the time, and it is a modernist icon. The same is true of the restaurant, which opened in 1959 and was the most expensive restaurant ever built up to then and maybe now, the equivalent of $35 million or so.
And so this considerable investment, was that unusual at the time in the interior design of restaurants? I mean, it's clearly making a statement when you use materials of that quality and rarity for a restaurant.
Well, it always was typical of a certain kind of American restaurant to have a spectacle and have a show. So in the 19th century, it might be chandeliers and mahogany paneling, or the look of an English club or a French chateau. So showmanship with like flaming dishes or waiters in costumes is pretty much as old as American restaurants. But this modernist, severe, elegant, up-to-date look, restrained, and with a lot of space, which to this day is a luxury in New York, that was new, and that was the product of Baum's vision.
This place was obviously a place of buzz, a place of kind of febrile intensity, despite the kind of cool, detached modernism of the interior and the space, maybe between the tables, but certainly between the heads of the diners and the ceiling above. As you say, it was a rarity in New York City and still is. What can you describe the kind of buzz in that room when you have big magazine editors, industrialists, fashion designers, and the great, the good, the beautiful, and the damned all in that room at one time? You could kind of cut the atmosphere with a blunt spoon, I presume.
Definitely. And unlike some restaurants or clubs, for that matter, this room, one of two, so the grill room or bar room, as it was called, was organized so that you could see everybody who was there from any table, but they were far enough apart so you could have a confidential conversation. And the buzz, the important thing about the buzz, I guess, is it's not just social. I mean, we're all used to table hopping and Hollywood or, you know, London stage places where the people know each other and are all celebrities or would be celebrities. This was people who are not really celebrities in their own right, but deal makers, celebrities within the world of, say, literary agents or advertising people or people involved in the wine business. So they were not celebrities that newspaper gossip columnists would care about, but they were people who were networking and doing deals. And that's part of what's new over lunch.
This is an interesting distinction you make here, Paul, between the kind of page sixification of a restaurant, you might well call it, and that sort of secret society kind of atmosphere, or that kind of atmosphere that everyone's getting along very well and everyone is a little bit nosy about what's happening on the other table. There is an atmosphere of pride in being there, but not in prurience, perhaps, at the kind of goings-on that are happening there. This isn't Studio 54, is it?
That's exactly right, Robert. It's more like a kind of place where you have to show yourself, mm-hmm. to show that you're in business and doing deals, so that it's not a bar, it's not a nightclub, it's not even a conventional elegant restaurant. It becomes something that we're now familiar with because, you know, now we have like networking events at places. But the whole idea of networking in this way, of having meals oriented around deal making, this was new in the 1970s. The restaurant, as I said, was founded in 1959, but it took it about 15 years to figure this out and, in fact, to start making money, because it was one of these places that everybody admired at first, but they actually had lots and lots of trouble making a profit.
Now, this is a sign of the times as well, Paul. I mean, 15 years for a restaurant to hit its stride. Most restaurants go out of business in, you know, 6 months to a year in New York City these days, and presumably throughout the 80s and the 90s as well. But was there an idea of simply the kind of quality, whether of the room or of the food or of the atmosphere of this place, that the people that controlled it simply didn't want it to die until it hit its stride in the 70s.
I think that's right. It was heavily subsidized by the Seagram family. The Seagram family had paid for this over-the-top design, and the rent was nominal, or if not nominal, at least not extortionate, which is the same thing in New York as nominal. And the people who owned the building were pleased at the success of the restaurant in terms of prestige and not looking at the bottom line. So it did, however, start to become very profitable. And ironically, in this grill or bar room, the other room, the pool room, which has a square marble bordered pool in the middle, was much more popular and was a tourist destination or a wedding anniversary kind of celebration place. That was always pretty well filled. What changed with the Power Lunch beginning in the mid-70s at the nadir of New York City's fortunes, when New York almost became bankrupt, was that the grill room was now the place for the Power Lunch.
We're very much talking here about the atmosphere of this room. We haven't mentioned the food. I'm sure it was good, but presumably the people behind this restaurant, the Seagram family and the people that worked for them and with them, concentrated on making a good room rather than a finickety restaurant. We're talking about atmosphere rather than gastronomy, aren't we here?
That's right. In the 70s, the grill room had a rather severe power broker kind of food, paillard of chicken, that sort of thing. Nothing very exotic. But the original concept of the restaurant was a menu of such wild innovation, tradition, and variety. But that actually was one of the reasons why they didn't make any money. I mean, they had something called a bouillabaisse salad. They had whole
wow.
Perigord truffles with prosciutto in pastry. They probably were the last place in New York or anywhere in the U.S. to serve terrapin, American turtles,
yeah.
which had been the most prestigious dish like 100 years earlier, and maybe the first place to serve nasturtium leaves and wild greens, which have now become, of course, an ordinary item. So they had a lobster parfait with mint. They had potted squabs with salsify in wild game marinade. The list goes on and on. I won't bore your listeners by just reciting the menu. But the original concept, and to some extent the pool room for much of the time of the restaurant, had a fantastic menu. The cooking was regarded as uneven. At times, it was felt by reviewers that they overreached, that if they had kind of fewer dishes and concentrated on them more, they might do better. And they had things like a kind of tree that came out on a cart with various kinds of sausages and salamis. They had another so-called herring cart with different kinds of marinated and smoked fish. They had a lot of flambé dishes, even though the founder, Joe Baum, said he wasn't going to flambé dishes because he knew it was vulgar and Hollywoodish. They couldn't resist. They had beef stroganoff flambéed at the table, naturally.
I was going to say, all these things, whether it's beef stroganoff flambéed at the table or crepe Suzanne or whatever it might be, these are the things of show. These are the culinary equivalents of the shoulder pads of the 80s, right?
Exactly. And you'd have to go to Las Vegas now probably to find that kind of atmosphere.
We'll hear more from Paul later on in the show, but let's head to the Four Seasons itself. Tomorrow, you'll have the chance to own a little piece of history as the chairs, tables, pots, pans and cutlery all go under the hammer within the walls that have been their home for so long. The sale is being run by the auction house Wright, and we sent our reporter Aidan McLaughlin for a tour of the items up for sale with founder and president Richard Wright.
So the restaurant opens in 1959. It really, at that time, and for many decades after, was the most expensive restaurant ever built. A really fascinating statistic, the Guggenheim opened the same year, and the budget was the exact same for the Guggenheim Museum. That gives you some sense of the amount of luxury that is in these spaces. And as a result, I mean, you know, not as a result of the money, but as a result of the kind of total work of art that was created here and their ability to just spare no expense, they created a room that is like no other in New York. For me, the magic of the Four Seasons begins with just the sheer volume of these spaces, and it sets a sort of decadence of space that is very rare in this city. Pool room is great theater to have the very center, and it's not a small pool. It's a, you know, the center of the room is a fountain with flanked by four very large planters. That was an economics weren't the deciding factor in any of these. It was really a theater, and they really created just the most special ambiance.
At the moment, it's open for a public viewing, and the auction is set for July 26th. Who do you expect to attend the auction and actually bid on the pieces? Former patrons, or what do you think the clientele will be?
Well, it'll be a combination. I think a large percentage of the audience will be former patrons, for sure, that are here to buy a piece of the history that they participated in. But also, many of our regular clientele are interested, and we do have international interest, but here in the room we'll have local design collectors, local interior designers, local architects, and some of the local museums will be bidding.
So we're sitting right now at Philip Johnson-designed banquets that were made by Nall for the Four Seasons, and this one is actually Philip Johnson's personal favorite, where he used to come and dine. Can you tell me a little bit about this banquet?
Sure. I mean, this is a famed banquet where Philip Johnson would hold court for lunch nearly every day, any day that he was in New York, always reserved for him. As you can see, we're sighted in the corner, great sight lines for the entire room, where he could be seen and he could see who was coming in. It was a very coveted invitation to be invited to dine with Johnson, who could be a very challenging table mate and would keep you on your toes. Many people who have come through from the design community who are lucky enough to have been invited back in the day and have many fond memories. Definitely one of the top lots in the sale. We're also going to be selling the entrance sign from 52nd Street. The logo of the Four Seasons is fantastic. So it's hand-drawn by an illustrator, Emil Antonucci, with the beautiful trees, and then the hand-drawn lettering has just been signature, one of the great graphic identities. I mean, the lettering
is just wonderful.
Yeah, it's really fantastic.
What do you think the bid's going to be on that?
So the estimate's 5,000 to 7,000. Mm-hmm. I would like to think it would sell for easily double. I mean, I think mm-hmm. the true value of it is significantly more than the estimate.
It's such an iconic sign.
I mean, you see these trees and you know exactly, you know, where you are. And I think it just, again, of like the great graphic design from mid-century, this is right there. And, you know, it's fantastic. So we're even selling a few items from the kitchen. We couldn't resist. There's one cotton candy machine that famously, when you would finish a very fancy dinner, formal dinner in the pool room, you could end with some cotton candy and have that childlike joy that everybody really, if you just taste it, you can't resist it. And we're selling the cotton candy machine from the Four Seasons. It's an honor.
And it must have been an interesting kind of paradox to have, to be in such a kind of one of the fanciest and most expensive restaurants in New York, and to be able to actually like get cotton candy from an old mid-century cotton candy machine.
I think that's, you know, again, one of the great things about the Four Seasons is, you know, they could play against type, and, you know, they made it fun. It was a fun experience. Restaurant associates were great showmen, and that continues on. The current owners, Alex and most notably Julian Nicolini, great showmen, and they know that's part of the hospitality, and they've always made sure everybody had a little bit of fun. So we're here in the bar of the Four Seasons, which is in part of the grill room. The bar is one of the really famous bars of New York. The space is made more intimate by the famous sculpture that hangs above the bar by Richard Lippold. That is landmarked, will be remaining, thankfully, as will the bar. But some of my favorite pieces in the sale are right here around the bar. The bar stools were custom designed by Mies van der Rohe for the restaurant. You know, Mies designed a very small number of furniture pieces in his career, and actually designed these for this place. So there are 20 of them. They'll be sold in 10 lots, so you can buy them in pairs. A really, you know, special item. We also have the bronze top Saarinen tables, which, again, unique, done for the restaurant. Famous Eero Saarinen tulip table, almost ubiquitous now in continuous production. These were from 1959, custom polished bronze tops. Only 6 of them exist. Really just a great piece of history.
Now, we couldn't really talk about the Four Seasons without mentioning what was hanging on the walls. The restaurant was something of a canvas for the greats of abstract expressionism that would very soon become household names, even if they weren't already. Think Rothko, Picasso and Pollock, amongst others. Art advisor and dealer Kathleen Fox-Davies tells us about these names that adorn the walls of the Four Seasons.
When the Four Seasons opened in 1957, the designers actually went out purchasing amazing modern pieces. You've got names like Picasso, Mark Rothko, you have Jackson Pollock. They were museum quality pieces. You actually had the at the time the director of the Museum of Modern Art advising on what pieces should be there to be the defining visual element of modernity.
This is quite unbelievable, isn't
it? It's amazing. Yeah. When it opened, it was the most opulent, the most sophisticated, the most chic restaurant in the world. It was a defining gem of Manhattan. And it still is up until the closing, but it defined a certain era that perhaps is ending. And I think that that's what, with the closing of the Four Seasons restaurant, that's that amazing shift of almost a new regime of what's going to come in, modern to contemporary. But what was there, it started out with Jackson Pollock, that then was removed to make way for these amazing commissioned Mark Rothko paintings that were meant to be created specifically for the space. At the time that they were purchased, it was the largest commission for a living artist that had ever been recorded. So it was kind of unbelievable, Mark Rothko coming from really poor background and roots, all of a sudden being the highest paid artist in Manhattan. And he struggled with negotiating that status and actually ended up pulling the commission, paying back all the money, because having his artwork sit in an opulent restaurant serving the power broker, the Manhattan elite, the top percent, if you will, of Wall Street, was against everything he stood for.
Yeah, we think of him as an insecure, as an insular, as a, I don't know, as a troubled artist for obvious reasons. We don't expect him to be taking commissions from kind of let's fill a big space on this
exactly, for a restaurant. But that was part of what the restaurant
wanted to be able and, to have that and, buying power
and
that pulling power
and remained. Yeah, you had a Picasso curtain mural that was in the hallway between the two dining rooms, and that actually made headlines and marked the beginning of the end of the Four Seasons, because the new building owner wanted to remove that curtain and that mural, and the Landmark Conservation Agency got wind of this and actually had a restraining order taken out against Abby Rosen, the owner of the building, that he couldn't touch the Picasso in his own building. And that really showed, and it played out, it was quite ugly, but it played out this weird dichotomy between the modern
respect for history, I suppose.
Respect for history and what the Four Seasons stood for in the artwork and that defined modern New York that sat on the walls, both historically and before its closing, and the eye of a well-known contemporary collector that would have much rather have pulled everything off and put in quite flash Jeff Koons, Damien Hirst, which there's nothing wrong with, but it's the changing of the guard.
Yeah, it is kind of the story of New York made, well, writ large in one room. And I wonder what it was like sitting there. You know, were you able to look at the artworks, or was there always something more demanding of your attention in the room, whether it was a well-known face or just the atmosphere of a deeply buzzy restaurant?
I think it's a deeply buzzy restaurant and that every element was so well thought out going into the design and the creation that the furniture is artwork as well as the pieces that are museum quality on the wall. But it all just sort of melded into the atmosphere of one of the most opulent spaces that New York could offer.
And it's interesting, you talked about, you know, Rothko, Pollock, Picasso, these sort of titans of 20th century art. In the 50s, when this place opened, these certainly in London at least, these artists weren't part of the mainstream. They weren't embraced with open arms. They were still controversialists,
weren't
they? What about New York at that time? Was it that much further ahead?
I think it was... It was the defining art movement in New York at the time. Abstract Expressionism was born in New York and defined the 1950s. And some people got it and some people did not get it. But it was a forward-looking avant-garde place defining that modern moment. And the work that they put on the walls, they set out to find the new, hot, bright, young thing. So Jackson Pollock, Mark Rothko, you have Miro, you've got Robert Rauschenberg, you have Picasso. They were the names that were burning up the art galleries at the time. No, they did not have the cachet that they have now, but in the same way that the young British artists in the late 80s, early 90s were really making headway and making news and creating new ways of looking at things here in London, and they're now superstars.
Well, it's a great loss as well then. So this restaurant, I know you personally are going to be... Going to be sad to see this one float out into the harbour, right?
I am. The restaurateurs will be relocating, but it loses that historical grounding of why people went there. You go for the experience, you go for the history, you go for the fact that it is so definitive of that old New York time. And it will be sad to see that go. It will be very interesting to see what will be put in its place, though, because from my understanding, Abby Rosen is striving to create the new New York defining restaurant with the artists that he sees as the most collectible and in this moment. So it'll be something, hopefully, that will define now in the later years to come.
Bon chance, Mr. Rosen. Kathleen, thank you very much. We've discussed the walls, we've inspected the furniture, and we've talked about some of the guests who dined with one eye on their Maryland crab meat cakes and the other on the neighbouring table. But if you were going to bid for one item in the upcoming sale, what would it be? We're going back to our historian and author, Paul Friedman.
I'd want anything with the emblem of the restaurant, which is four different colored little sketched out trees in different states of leaves. So winter, obviously, it's just branches. Spring, it's little dots on the branches. Summer, it's full leaves. I can't remember exactly what fall is, but you get the idea. It's a very recognizable logo. It's on their plates. Their serving dishes. Those are what I would like to have.
And the restaurant is reinventing itself. The people that have been running it for the last 25 years or so have said that they're going to launch another space within 5 blocks or a 15-minute walk, I can't remember, which from the old building, the old restaurant. What are the chances, do you think, of reinvigorating the atmosphere and the excitement of that old Four Seasons room?
I think a lot's going to depend on the design, and we don't know that. We know it's going to be, as you said, a few blocks south of the old place on Park Avenue again. And I'm sure the owners of the building that they're relocating to are going to expend a lot of effort on making a beautiful and inviting space. I think opinion is divided. Some people say you can never reproduce those rooms, and therefore the particular atmosphere can't be reintroduced. And since the food was good but not regarded as unique anymore, maybe it's a hard proposition to see them succeeding. On the other hand, these two guys, Alex Von Bitter and Julian Nicolini, are geniuses at being hosts, which is a vanishing art. That is, they know their customers, they make them welcome, they create a gracious atmosphere, and this is not unknown elsewhere in New York, but it's not at all common. So I think they've got a good chance, actually, just on the basis of the owners.
An interesting point I just wanted to ask you about, actually, was I interviewed Jeremy King from Corbin and King Restaurants here in the UK a couple of weeks ago. And he said to me, show me a restaurant with a great view and I'll show you a boring restaurant. In that actually the attention of the restaurant, of the diners, of the atmosphere of the room should be sort of directed inward and around the place. Would you perhaps recommend something similar for the new outpost of the Four Seasons, Paul, that it be a room not necessarily down some stairs, but not with a commanding view of Manhattan, that it perhaps has to, again, like the famous design of this restaurant we're talking about, you should be able to see whoever's there, but you should be far enough apart to have a confidential conversation?
I agree entirely. Certainly things like restaurants at the top of hotels or revolving restaurants at the top of the Seattle World's Fair, they've got to be bad, almost by definition. So that doesn't mean that you don't expend a lot of attention on an actual interior, but it's important for the people to be looking at the place, looking at their food, looking at who's there, and not at the view. I would say I agree entirely. And that lesson needs to be relearned again and again, but that's true of a lot of things in life, isn't it?
And just finally, Paul, there is such lore and legend surrounding the Four Seasons rooms. If there was a night or a table, whether it was of regulars or a one-off evening, that you would have wanted to have been the fourth or fifth diner at, who would you have accompanied to dinner at the zenith of the Four Seasons?
I think Henry Kissinger. Henry Kissinger is one of the people who was an early power lunch regular in the 70s and remains to this day. So Henry Kissinger in the times when he was the most influential maker of American foreign policy, probably him. Failing that, actually, this is an odd choice, but literary agents. I'm always fascinated by how stars were born in the world of fiction and of reporting of politics. And when I asked the owner, one of the owners, Alex Von Bitter, recently whether he still had a lot of publishers and literary agents as the power brokers in the grill room, he looked at me pityingly as if I'd asked for where the nearest telephone booth was or pay telephone was,
Sign of the times, right?
We don't have those people here anymore. It's all finance.
That was Paul Friedman, professor of history at Yale University and author of 10 Restaurants That Changed America. That'll be published by Liverite this September. So it's the end of an era, the winter of a certain amount of discontent at the closing of the Four Seasons. But hey, if you're feeling reminiscent, ring Wrights and raise your hand at tomorrow's sale. A cruet set, a service of plates, a banquette if you're feeling flush. As for the legacy, well, rooms have feelings too, or we have feelings about them. Can you move down the road and expect service to be resumed? I don't expect such experienced restaurateurs have any such desire, but they'll surely look through the photo album of a half century of lunches with a dewy eye. Well, that brings us to the end of today's show. Don't forget that the sale of the nuts and bolts of the Four Seasons is happening on Tuesday, 26th of July, probably tomorrow. Head to right20.com for more information. You've been listening to Culture, where my producer was Holly Fisher, whose appetizer was ever the Etcetera caviar. Join me again at the same time next week. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bound, and thank you very much for tucking in.